Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Deborah Noyes. Noyes is a writer and photographer. She's published many books for children and young adults, including The Encyclopedia of the End, Mysterious Death in Fact, Fancy, Folklore, and More, and One Kingdom, Our Lives with Animals. Her short fiction has appeared in 17 Magazine and 3 Penny Review. She is also the author of 2 well-received novels. Her first, Angel and Apostle, was published in 2005, and her most recent is called Captivity. It's a fascinating historical novel centered around the strange but true tale of the Fox sisters, 2 young women in upstate New York in the mid-1800s who proclaimed they could converse with the dead, thus giving birth to the American spiritualist movement. Captivity was published earlier this month by Unbridled Books. I'm speaking to Deborah Noyes by phone from her office in Massachusetts. Deborah Noyes, thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Well, great. Now, in addition to writing, you've taken 2 other creative paths. That's illustration and photography. Now, were these 3 interests developed early, or was this something that evolved through the years?
Well, I think I wanted to be an artist when I was very young, but I wasn't very talented. And I gradually, moved into photography, and that was a channel for that. But I do have a visual sense that I wanted to entertain and use in my work in some way, and it's gradually been folded into the writing. So, but I don't illustrate, actually. I photo illustrate, but I can't draw worth a lick.
Oh, really? I understood that you were also an illustrator.
No, I wish I could. I've photo illustrated other authors' books, children's books. So.
I see. Well, do you remember when you first started writing? What were you writing? The same as most authors, did you start out writing poetry?
I did play with poetry a little bit. I mean, I think that the language remains important to me, but it definitely, I experimented more with it when I was starting out, I think. And in part, that's probably, just the way you learn to craft a sentence in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't write it anymore, apart from I write children's picture books, and some of those texts have been, poetic in nature, I guess, but they're not strictly poems, I guess.
Uh-huh. I noticed that in several of your children's and young adult book themes, there's this recurring theme of ghosts and death and the dead. Now, where did this fascination with these subjects come from?
It's funny. Yeah, I think in some ways I can trace it back to my mom. She always had these yellowing yard sale copies of books lying around with women, running away from spooky castles on them, things like Daphne du Maurier and Mary Stuart. So I was reading those alongside my Little House on the Prairie books from a very young age. And somebody teased me recently and said, you should write Little House, Haunted House on the Prairie. But those two things just sort of gelled for me. And I think the historical and the spooky or the somewhat unsettling appealed to me, that gothic sensibility, I guess. I read a lot of gothic literature in college, and it's definitely always been a part of my literary view, I guess.
Uh-huh. And you know what? When I was a kid, I was interested in ghost stories. It seems like kids are never tired of
that
theme.
Yeah, my own daughter right now is going through that. She, of course, is not interested in mine at all, but in other people's ghost stories, she's very she's fascinated by being scared. The idea of being scared is very appealing to her, and yet she wants me to read them to her. She wants the safety of that as well, so it's an interesting kind of paradox, I think.
Oh, yeah. Now, you turned to adult fiction and published your first novel in 2005. It was called Angel and Apostle. To tell us a little bit about that, and what was the segue into writing adult fiction about?
Well, I always wrote adult fiction. I was actually in an MFA program and, wrote a lot of short stories. The novels that I started never quite gelled, and I think that was partly because I was trying to write contemporary fiction, and I've learned since that, my own sensibility, that I need both the structure and the nourishment that historical gives me, to be able to dip into history at any given point and pull something out. That's been my saving grace, I think, as a writer. It really is the kind of writer I needed to be, and I didn't know that then.
Hmm.
So I went away from writing for adults for a time, I think, because I was still figuring out what sort of writer I was. And then I had children, and I started working in children's books as an editor, and I fell in love again with children's literature, and so I took a segue there, really, and then came back out on the other side and started writing for adults again once I discovered the historical bent that I had.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about Angel and Apostle. It's a fascinating theme that you've enriched.
Yeah, it's a story of, if you remember Hester Prynne from Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter,
mm-hmm.
there was also the daughter, the elf child, as he referred to her, Pearl Prynne, and she is the character that I picked up from Hawthorne's book and tried to, not only envision her side of things as a child, but also carry her into adulthood and look at where having that background and that badge of dishonor what it did to her as the daughter of a woman scorned, so to speak, or a woman for whom life was difficult.
And did you do a lot of research about that era?
I did. I read a lot of primary sources. I always do find those the most, certainly for the rhythms. You know, I read a lot of Samuel Pepys, who was a great diarist during the Restoration in London. He was very irreverent and funny. So I read a lot of his diaries, which gave me a lot of insight into the time because he was quite descriptive, and he talked about the plague and the fire of London. And so that was a great resource for me. But I do. I read recipes. I read etiquette books, you know, anything that will give me insight into that time. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how much manners will teach you about a time, you know, that the way people dressed, the way they spoke, the way they carried themselves, the rules, as it were, for society.
You know? Yeah, that is a way to find cultural touchstones, isn't it? That's amazing.
Yeah.
Now, I want to talk, obviously, about your new book, Captivity. It's a fascinating book. Tell us a little bit about this, and then we'll talk about some specifics.
Okay. Well, it's a historical novel set in mid-19th century, mostly in Western New York, but partly in London. It's three narrative strands, and the first picks up the real-life Fox sisters, who were these two ordinary farm girls named Maggie and Kate, who in 1848, on a March night, riveted their family by reporting that they could communicate with the dead via rapping on the walls. When they rapped, the spirit or the presence in the house rapped back. So the family called in neighbors, the neighbors came, the neighbors, you know, helped them fashion a sort of system of rap and response, an alphabetic system. They figured out there was, you know, apparently a spirit of a dead peddler who had been murdered in the house and buried in the cellar. So, you know, people came from all over. They started digging up the cellar. They started camping out in the yard. You know, people came in carriages and buggies, and, you know, they literally lit bonfires. They came and looked in the windows. So it was an incredibly public event, and it spiraled out very quickly and got beyond that community and into the bigger community of New York. And the sisters ultimately became international celebrities, you know, by giving these seances. And celebrity mediums, sort of like Sylvia Brown today. But they were really the first, I guess, of their kind. And their elder sister, Leah, who was very opportunistic and ambitious, drove their career and ultimately, you know, sort of triggered the spiritualist movement.
Mm-hmm. The sister was sort of like the mid-19th century publicist.
Yeah, exactly. She was sort of their marketing handle. You know, she went around and set things up and put them on tour and really drove them and, just, you know, in some ways drove them too hard. I think Maggie and Kate resented ultimately her hold over them. But it's a fascinating family story, as well as, you know, the story of science and spirit, the questions that it brought up in society, because there was so much going on at the time, you know, with post-Darwin and the origin of the species, the whole idea of God and the afterlife had changed, and they really tapped into all of that anxiety and also the need that people had to continue believing in something and to shape that something into a movement, and they did. And ultimately, at the turn of the century, which was pretty much the peak, there were some million followers, including people like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, later First Lady Pierce, Horace Greeley, who was the editor of the Tribune in New York. So there were all sorts of supporters in very high places. So it wasn't just a sort of fluke that happened in one small community. Mm-hmm. It really branched out.
Mm-hmm. How did you get interested in this subject?
I got interested in it when I was working on a creative nonfiction book called Encyclopedia of the End, and I was researching Lilydale, which is a community in Western New York that every summer all of these mediums show up and they hang up their shingle and, you know, busloads of tourists come and they connect them with their dead. And it's a fascinating little bit of Americana, really. And, you know, Susan B. Anthony used to go, and Mae West, and all of these famous people, including Houdini, who would show up to sort of debunk and discredit false mediums because he was very much opposed to that. But prior, I went to Lilydale and they had an exhibit, a miniature exhibit of the Fox family cottage where all of this started. And in fact, the cottage itself had been transferred there at one point as an homage. You know, it was kept at the museum site and then burned down in, I think, the 50s. So I started reading about the Fox sisters, and I found an article in American History magazine that, you know, really detailed the whole sequence of events. And I was just fascinated by, you know, not only was it a rags-to-riches story, but it was just an incredible story of celebrity at a time when, you know, women had very few choices. And, you know, you could be a governess or you could be a wife. You could marry well.
Mm-hmm.
And these women fashioned this incredibly novel way of making a living for themselves at a time when it was very difficult to do so. So I was interested in that, too, and just how they shaped their careers. But it was, you know, it just raised all sorts of questions for me.
Mm-hmm. And actually, this was near our area. We were in the Finger Lakes here. So
yeah.
I know a lot of my listeners will be very interested. Now, I'm certain that you conducted quite a bit of research on this. Did you ever come upon whether this Fox sister phenomenon was a fake?
Well, I think that, you know, certainly all things point to that. In the end, Maggie did stand up, this is 40 years into it, and she stood up before a packed assembly at the New York Academy of Music and said that it was a hoax and that what they had been doing was cracking their toe joints to make the rapping sounds, even though throughout their lifetimes they had been investigated by all manner of, you know, committees, and they had demonstrated at Corinthian Hall, which at the time was the biggest auditorium in Rochester, three nights of extensive demonstrations and investigations. And that almost ended in them being tarred and feathered because people couldn't figure out how they were doing it. And there was anger. You know, they were called witches. There was all sorts of complexity around it and all different responses from the community around them. But I don't know that they ever completely were discredited except by Maggie's own admission, which she then recanted. She turned around later and said that it was true, that the spirits were true. So she, you know, I think she, you know, under Leah's manipulation, she was a bit confused about her own attitude toward what she was doing. But I do think there was a lot of play and a lot of showmanship involved. They were definitely, you know, whatever real or, you know, mediumistic abilities they may have had, they certainly were gifted showwomen, mm-hmm. and they knew how to work an audience and how to, you know, put together a really impressive seance that clearly nobody could figure out.
Yeah, and I love the way you portray this in your book, too, because you don't take either side.
Yeah,
you just presented
I feel strongly about that.
Yeah, it's very poetic, the book, by the way, Deborah. It's really beautifully written.
Thank you.
I want to ask you this. Historical fiction is tricky, and I would imagine because you need fictional concepts in order to connect the dots.
Right.
How did you navigate that? And also, was Clara Gill one of the characters? Was that a fictional character, or was she real?
Clara Gill is a fictional character, and in mm-hmm. fact, you know, she's a good answer to your question, in that she came about because I needed a sort of foil for Maggie. I needed a way to demonstrate Maggie's impact on people. And so I chose this one individual, Clara Gill, this woman who has she's essentially an agoraphobiac. She doesn't leave her house. She lives in Rochester alone with her father. She's British. She's in exile from England from a scandal. No, you know, nobody knows that necessarily, but she is referred to as Mad Clara because she doesn't go out of her house, and she's reputed to be, you know, very temperamental. And so Maggie ends up being a part-time parlor maid in her house while Leah is shaping their careers a bit. You know, things are hard. They need money. So she puts both Maggie and her own daughter, Lizzie, in service in the Gill household. And this is how Maggie and Clara connect. And Clara has suffered this tragedy and is basically still in mourning after all this time. So to meet Maggie creates an interesting possibility to explore Maggie's talents or lack thereof. And Clara is very skeptical. You know, she's a scientific person. She's a zoological artist. She really doesn't, you know, buy into any of this. And yet she has this need. And so I thought she would be a good way to explore the impact that Maggie and her sisters had on people, as even people who are incredibly educated and well-placed in society. It had nothing to do with, you know, how ignorant you were, how educated you were. It was all about need and about the willingness to suspend disbelief, I guess. So Clara was my way of exploring that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Deborah Noyes. She's an author and photographer, and we're talking about her recently released novel called Captivity. Now, I often wonder, and you're somebody who's interested in true historical places and times, well, what makes you decide to incorporate it into fiction instead of writing a straight nonfiction version of this story?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, there are wonderful nonfiction accounts of the Fox sisters, two of them in particular. And I won't be able to think of them right now because I'm trying. But they were sources that I used. But I just think that my bent is, you know, I think of myself as a storyteller. In the end, I always want to reshape the truth and make it, you know, whether it be neater or just more to my taste. I don't know. But I definitely think that fiction is the realm where I feel most comfortable as a writer because it gives me a chance to incorporate spontaneously storylines that as they come down the pike. I guess. Mm-hmm. I think a good creative nonfiction writer is doing that anyway, a narrative nonfiction writer. But somehow, I don't know, I think I wouldn't have discovered Clara and the other character, Will, who ended up, for me, being the emotional center of the book. So I needed to discover that. And the Fox sisters, in some ways, were my way into the story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, that's fascinating to me. You also write book reviews. Does your approach to book reviews change once you become an author yourself?
Yeah, actually, I don't do them anymore because, in part because of that, but in part because I also have a day job now that disallows it, but because I enjoy doing it. But it taught me a lot about writing, reviewing other people's books, because by, you know, sort of deconstructing what they had done, I was working through that process with them, and then I was able to think about all of those things when it came time to write my own books. So it was instructive to me, definitely, and also just to think about the different ways that writers, what makes them tick and how they think and the different approaches that people take to very similar content, you know, that was always very interesting to me, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I want to go back to the captivity one more time. I wanted to ask you this. Since a lot of this book is obviously based on real, true people, did you meet up with any relatives of the Fox sisters?
I did not.
Are there any?
Lilydale, uh-huh. And as I said, and I interviewed the then president of Lilydale, Ellen Bourne, who was very interesting, and she gave me a real perspective on the movement and the religion, because it is a religion as well. And there were points in our conversation where she would say, well, now you're talking, you know, philosophy, or you're talking spiritualist doctrine. You know, there were all these different, it's a very complex movement, and she was able to help me make sense of that. But no, I did not meet any of the actual descendants of the Fox family, although I did interview some people in Rochester and talk about some of the peripheral characters in the book, like Amy Post, who is a real person, mm-hmm. a Quaker and a major figure at the time in Rochester. And I was able to, you know, speak with librarians and people in Rochester who were able to give me more insights into that time, into what people were discussing and what the attitudes were about all of these things that were floating about in the sort of what they call the burned over region, you know, of progressive ideas that were rampant at the time, and, you know, mesmerism and Mormonism and all of these things were coming to be at the same time that Edison had introduced his telegraph, and there was this idea that, you know, we could not only communicate with each other in far-flung places, but maybe even communicate beyond as well. I was able to get a lot of background, I guess, from the people I spoke to, but nothing direct.
Mm-hmm. Well, what an interesting time that is, too.
Yeah.
The mid-19th century. It's like the collision of science and superstition.
Right.
All coming together at once.
Yeah, and all sort of before, long, you know, the war is on the horizon, and, you know, the Civil War, you know, mm-hmm. So it was a fascinating time of, you know, sort of mixed up, you know, time of froth, a lot of ideas frothing.
Yeah, fascinating to me. Did you ever sit in on a seance or work with a Ouija board or do any of the...
I did, as a kid, I definitely, you know, played with Ouija boards and things. I remember a particularly vivid Girl Scout camp encounter where we were, toying with it. But, you know, Ellen, the woman I interviewed, actually gave me some insight into that. She said, well, if you were, you know, sitting having coffee in your kitchen, would you open the door and just let the first stranger that walked by come in? And then I said, of course not. She said, well, then why would anybody play with a Ouija board? Because that's what you're doing. You're inviting, you know, goodness knows who. And, you know, so it was an interesting perception. But I've never been to a seance. I have been to... you know, fortune tellers and palm readers and things like that for fun. I have to say I've always been fascinated, but I'm a very empirical person in the end. You know, I'm like Clara in that I'm pretty skeptical. But I enjoy the idea of it as a storyteller, of being able to, you know, predict or perceive the world in a way, you know, in a way that isn't obvious or immediate or empirical.
Mm-hmm. I do believe that there probably are things that we don't know, you know, and it, when, just because we don't believe in them doesn't mean they aren't there. It's interesting.
Yeah.
Now that you've written two novels, are you going to continue to write short fiction, or is that an entirely different genre that you're finished with?
No, I love short fiction. I do, and every now and then I contributed to an anthology, a young adult short story, and I do it periodically, but I wouldn't say I'm done with it. I just don't have anything immediate on the horizon, but I do love the form. I love short stories. I read them a lot.
Mm-hmm.
A lot.
It is a different form. I find it somewhat unsatisfying sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, if you get into a really good short story, you want it to continue.
Yeah.
You know, like a meaty novel, you don't want them to end, and short stories seem to sometimes end too abruptly for my taste.
Yeah, I do. I've heard that from many people, and my book, my young adult book, The Ghosts of Kerfall, is in fact a book of linked short stories, so it's a novel in stories, but I think I was getting my short story fix when I was writing it. So I've heard that from many people saying, you know, I want more meat, you know, I want mm-hmm. more from it afterward, but I don't know if it's just because I admire them on the level of sentences. They're so compact. They pack so much into so little. And like a good, you know, poem or a good picture book, I think they resonate out if they're done well. You know, somebody like Alice Munro can say way more in a short story than most of us can say in a novel of 300 pages. You know, it's a real art form when people do it well.
It is indeed an art form. Now, as we said, you have written and illustrated several children's books. So do you think the rise of the internet will make these kinds of books obsolete? Do kids still want picture books? And
this is the question of the day. It's certainly one that everybody is buzzing about. And I think I've had it said to me that, you know, books are containers, you know, that the real point is the content. And I think that to some extent that's true, but I also think that books are, as objects, are especially picture books, illustrated books, are, you know, they're an art form in and of themselves, and everything from typeface to the design and the paper choice, all of that adds up to, you know, an object that happens to be also, you know, content. And it's this incredible synergy when it works well, and the touch and feel and smell of a book. I think that maybe I'm sentimental or old-fashioned in saying that I'll miss that, but I certainly will if it does go south. But I think that children, particularly very young children, I mean, the act of being read to, too, is important. You know, having them in your lap, reading to them, turning the page together, pointing at the pictures. And, you know, I know they're experimenting with all sorts of readers, you know, Kindles or whatnot, you know, variations on that can accommodate pictures. But I still don't think we've gotten to the point where it's really competing yet with actual picture books. So I don't know. It's up in the air, and I think things are changing so rapidly that it's impossible to predict, you know, how far it's going to go and how far away from the book we'll get. But I think that books right now are still very much valued by enough people that, you know, they'll stick around for a while.
Yeah, I hope so, too. I'm one of those sentimental people like you.
Yeah. I mean, we grew up with, you know, I don't know. But they are, you know. They're
like a friend.
To hold,
it's a friend. A book was always a friend to me, and still is. Now, do you write a lot of nonfiction for children, too. Do you think kids, because there's so much information coming at them, do want more realistic books rather than fantasy books?
I think it depends. I mean, I think, you know, like adults, you know, sometimes I feel like I want a beach read. Sometimes I want something dense and heavy and challenging sometimes, you know. And I think kids are really the same way that we are, in that they like a variety of stuff. Certainly they say that boys, you know, are more reluctant readers, and they're more drawn toward nonfiction, toward the facts, and like their stories in that form. And whether that's true or not, I do think that, you know, every reader is different, just as we are. And I think offering them as many choices as possible is a good thing. But filtering that through, I don't know, there has to be, I feel like right now, like you say, with the internet, there's so much information out there. It's a flood of, you know, nonstop sensory data that's coming at us all the time. And, you know, I think it's more important than ever that the adults in kids' lives, librarians and teachers and parents, you know, just sort of help them find the best of what's out there to read, because you don't want to, you know, inundate them with just this or just that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm worried about reading, period.
Yeah,
because it seems like I meet a lot of kids who don't read well. That's right. Quite
my
shocking.
Own, you know, he'll kill me for saying it, but my own son, he's not a reader at all. Which, you know, I've tried to offer him, you know, fair from every possible camp, you know, from sports books to, you know, adventure books. And, you know, he does dip in now and then, but it's just not something that he's drawn to.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas my daughter is a big reader, so it depends on the kid, I guess.
Yeah, there's so many distractions for kids, too. Now, before we run out of time, I do want to ask you this. You've been an editor for Candlewick Press, mm-hmm. and other publications. Well, what do you think is the most important job of an editor these days?
I think the most important job of an editor is to ask questions, you know, because when you're writing, you're very close to the material, and you tend to, at a certain point, you lack perspective. And a good editor just comes in and says, you know, well, have you thought about this, and what if this character were more developed, and what if you had structured it this way instead of that way? Would that add anything or take away? And, you know, just getting them thinking about it in novel ways that they maybe haven't, holding a mirror up to it in different angles, I guess.
And you have to learn how to be diplomatic, I would assume.
Yeah, you do, because it's, in the end, it's not your book. It's their book, and you can offer them guidance or, again, ask questions, but you can't write it for them. It's theirs. It's mm-hmm. their baby. You're just the midwife, you know.
Do you think being an editor has helped you also as a writer?
Definitely, definitely. They're two jobs inform each other constantly. But I, you know, sometimes also feel like I'm dipping from the same well, so it gets a little tired. You know, I sometimes just want to shut my brain off and do something completely different, but because they are so related.
Yeah, I would think being an editor would make you also a fairly good editor of your own work, but perhaps not, you know? I mean...
yeah. Well, I think I'm not, you know, copy editing is a whole different art form. I mean, I'm sort of more of a developmental editor, so I work with the bigger questions, I guess, but the copy editors who get down to the real nitty-gritty are you know, that's a totally different talent, and I need them desperately, on both counts, as a writer and an editor. It's wonderful to, you know... collide with them and hear their thoughts after the fact.
Now you've taught creative writing, and I assume you still teach in some ways. What are some of the most important things you would tell for budding writers?
Well, I think, you know, reading as much as you can, both in the area that you hope to succeed in and in other areas as well, just to keep your mind open. I've learned everything I've learned from books, you know, ironically, it's what we do, but it's the first and foremost, I think. But also just give yourself time, treat it as an apprenticeship. A lot of people think that writers spring from the soil fully formed, and they don't. You know, they need an apprenticeship the same way a violinist needs to train. And, you know, don't assume that you're going to get out there and immediately start publishing. It's important to, you know, go through that process and allow yourself to learn all that you need to learn, because you'll regret it if somebody publishes you when you're not ready, so to speak. And everybody's ready at a different point. So that would be my biggest advice, I think. Mm-hmm. Be patient and really study your craft.
Now, you've put two major novels out for the public to scrutinize. Have there been any surprises? Well, was it scary for you to put your babies out there for people to scrutinize?
Very scary. And especially with the first book, Angel and Apostle, because when I set out, I don't think I thought about how audacious I was being and taking a classic that way and trying to, you know, reopen it or retell some of it. Some people had a visceral response to that, or actually editors would often say, you know, when my agent would send it out, they would say, oh, you're very brave to take this on, take on Hawthorne. And I thought, I'm not trying to take on Hawthorne. But it was a little bit more than I had anticipated, a little bit more of a reaction about that. So that was very scary, but it turned out pretty well. And I think, you know, a lot of the reviews, I felt very, very satisfied with the work that I had been able to do with help from Hawthorne.
Yeah. You know, so. That was a fascinating idea. And you're getting really good reviews for Captivity. I'm delighted to hear that.
Yeah, people have been very thoughtful. I think it's a subject that seems to interest a lot of people, the Fox sisters.
Well, Deborah Noyes, we're almost out of time. What are you working on next? Anything real quickly you can tell us about?
I'm working on a young adult novel set in Florence during the plague, and it features a doppelganger, so going back to some spooky stuff, I guess, a little bit lighter, a little bit more pacey, I guess.
The plague is lighter?
Well, that's my idea of light. No, I'm kidding. But it's pitched toward young adults, so it's definitely a different pace, a different tempo. You know, I don't linger on the language as much as I do, I think, in my adult books, for better or worse. But I do think of young adult books as equally valuable and important, and I enjoy writing them.
Uh-huh. Well, we'll look forward to that. Can you give out some contact information, people to go to your website?
Oh, absolutely. It's just DeborahNoyes.com. All one word, Deborah, DeborahNoyes.
Well, great. I've been talking to author and photographer Deborah Noyes, and we've been talking about her new novel, Captivity. Deborah Noyes, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tish. It's been great.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.